This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Hey, this is Jason Hartman. Thank you so much for joining me. Do you know what day it is? Yes, it is Flashback Friday, where you hear the best of the Creating Wealth show, and you hear some good prior episodes, some good review. Remember, we've got almost 500 episodes out, and you know what? iTunes doesn't even hold them all if you're an iTunes listener. If you are listening on Stitcher, thank you for joining us. So we want to bring you some good review stuff. Now, what's interesting about Flashback Friday, it's a little scary for me. I gotta be very, very candid with you on that, because you, the listener, you get the chance to hold my feet to the fire. Did I make any predictions? Was I right? Was I wrong? I've been right about a lot of things, but I've been wrong about a few. But it's Flashback Friday, and we will give you the uncensored best of the Creating Wealth show with a prior episode. So let's dive in. Here we go. Remember, this is not current. It's Flashback Friday.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman. So we're glad to have you here today. As you regular listeners know, a 10th show, we go off topic. And we go, I really should clarify, we go off topic for the guest portion of the show, because we got a couple of business things to talk about here as they relate to finance, investment, and economics. And it also happens to be, as we're recording this, Valentine's Day. So happy Valentine's Day, everybody. And I've got Steve here with me. We got a little thing we want to do talking about marriage and financial wealth, and also the best trade of the last 20 years before we get to our guest today, which is Dr. Judith Wright, who's going to talk about soft addictions and transformation. So this soft addiction topic is pretty interesting. And when I say that, I don't know if you know what I mean, but soft addictions are these little minor addictions that don't really seem like a big deal, but they kind of run our lives to some extent. And you'll hear more about that when we have our guest on for this 300th episode and talk about soft addictions. And I think you'll get a lot out of it. It was pretty interesting. Steve, how you doing?
Great. I'm honored to be a part of the 300th show. We've got 300 under the belt here and still more to talk about. You just can't shut us up.
Yeah, that's for sure. We got a lot to talk about. And by the way, we've got the Steve Forbes interview coming up. I interviewed him last week, so we'll play that here in the next couple of episodes. And we've got Jack Canfield and Mark Faber coming on the show. So more big, big names. You might know, wow, Jack Canfield from Chicken Soup for the Soul and a whole bunch of other books. And, you know, he's done some great work. He's got some fantastic books, and he's a great speaker. And then Mark Faber is known on CNBC as Mr. Doom and Gloom. And so I guess those are kind of opposite, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Totally. Yeah. I didn't know you had Faber coming on. I really like his stuff, and it's more credible because of the accent, of course.
Yeah, of course that accent does make him more credible. Yes. Americans love accents. But it's funny because I remember I used to have an assistant who was South African, and she said, you know, she was a young gal, very attractive. And she said, Jason, when you go to visit South Africa, the girls are going to fall in love with you and your accent. You go down there with your accent, and you will just... you'll have such a good time. And I'm like, well, I didn't think I had an accent, but I love their accent. You know,
I know it's true. It's all relative. My wife and I were on vacation in Fiji, and there was a little girl in the pool that started talking to my wife, and she was from Australia. And my wife said, I like your accent. And her mom came over and said, you're the one with the accent.
Yeah, there you go. It's all relative. Definitely. It's all relative. Well, hey, before we jump into it, we're going to talk about marriage and how that affects financial success before we get to our guest.
Remember, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and Wednesday.
I really want to play this CNBC video for the audience, and it's a few minutes long, so just listen in, but I think you'll find this very enlightening. It was just released 3 days ago, and it's entitled The Best Trade of the Past 20 Years, and I'm going to play it. I might pause it and make a comment here and there, but I'll probably play it right through, and we'll probably get about four and a half minutes of this video in, and then we'll quit it. It's about 5.5 minutes long, but I don't think we need to listen to the whole thing. So just to give proper attribution, this is from CNBC, CNBC.com. You can find the video there, but it makes a great point. Now, what do they mean by the best trade in 20 years? Well, you know, of course, CNBC focuses on stocks and trading. And Bill Bonner of Agora Financial fame and the Daily Reckoning, and, you know, he's written a couple of books. We've had the number two Agora guy on two shows, actually, Addison Wiggin. And they're a financial publisher. We've had a lot of their different guests on the show over the years and a lot of their different writers. But they talk about the trade of the decade. And the trade of the decade in 2000, they predicted would be gold. And people that bought gold did not do better than people who bought good income property. But income property being dependent on location and being dependent on the exact deal, you know, and whether or not you were a buy and hold investor or a speculator, your income property results certainly vary. The thing that's so simple about gold is, of course, it's a one-dimensional asset class. It doesn't produce income. It doesn't have tax benefits. You can't finance it, or at least not in any real way. I know there are sort of some schemes out there where you kind of can, but not in any real way. But it's really easy to quantify. So they predicted the trade of the decade, and they said, hey, 10 years later, they were right. And they were definitely right compared to stocks and the S&P and the NASDAQ and all of that stuff, because, you know, in 10 years, those did virtually nothing. And then after inflation, they actually lost value. But they said the trade of the decade in 2010, they said that would be, and forgive me because I'm not going to remember this correctly, but I remember reading in the Daily Reckoning 2.5-3 years ago, and they said it would be to buy, I think they said buy Japanese bonds. And I don't know if that one's going to work out too well. And they had one other part of that trade, and I can't remember what it is, but, you know, we should look that up and see if they're going to be right again. So CNBC here, that's what I mean by the trade of the decade. Now, we made our own trade of the decade. We said, you know, in 2010, the trade of the decade would be income property. And so far, we are turning out to be incredibly right about that, cash flowing income property being the trade of the decade. But this is going to be an interesting video, so listen to it, and we will, of course, Steve, comment after. I may actually pause it during if I feel we just got to have a comment. Okay, so here we go. All right, here we go.
20 years. I know people want to know what it is. Why don't you tell them?
Well, I don't know that it's the greatest trade, but it's a good trade based on all the things that we're looking for, contrarian play, market barriers to entry, and mispricings. And so when we look at a trade, we're always just trying to figure out what is the best mispricing at the moment. And usually that follows some governmental intervention. And today that happens to be foreclosed single family housing. And if you look at the arena in which we're dealing, you have 120 million single family units that exist. And unfortunately for America, and unfortunately for the average American, about 6 million of those 120 million are delinquent, default, or foreclosed today. About 6 million have already been foreclosed upon. So the delivery of how those foreclosed units, the shadow inventory that existed within the banking sector, which was really the toxic waste dump for banking for a long time, how that gets resolved leaves a beneficiary to those who can buy those assets below replacement cost, rehabilitate them, lease them, manage them, and provide an alternative for the average Americans to home ownership.
So great point there. The opportunity to buy below replacement cost is disappearing very, very quickly. But that's what our clients do. They get these properties through our local market specialist. The local market specialist handles the rehab for them in almost every case, not every single case. And then we help with the overseeing of the property management side of the business. And it's just a great trade. Steve, any comments before we go back to the video?
Agreed. It's funny to think of it as a trade. I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah. Here we go back, okay?
No, affordability is at the all-time lowest because of subsidized interest rates.
Now, he actually means affordability is at the all-time highest.
Right,
okay,
right.
He actually misspoke there. It actually is, and I've said this on a prior episode, the affordability index that is published by the National Association of Realtors is the highest it's ever been since they started keeping track. And I believe that was in the early 70s, if I'm not mistaken. But here's the complexity about it, is that even though affordability is so good, it's the highest it's ever been, many people cannot qualify for those mortgages because the mortgages are tough to get. So again, he's going to talk here about providing rental housing to those people who can't. There's a lot of people that have really lost their credit score in the past few years in the financial crisis, making it an even better opportunity for landlords. Here we go.
Rental as an opportunity and an option for those that have had their credit impended or in credit purgatory because of delinquency or foreclosure or without a down payment, rental's an option.
We're simply talking about buying up single family homes and renting them out as the or one of the greatest investment opportunities that you've seen in the last 20 years. And you've been capitalizing on that. Overall, does housing look as good to you as people say it is to us?
Look, that's a tough question. The Fed has one major play in its playbook. That is to print money by hitting a character on a typewriter, use that printed capital to buy mortgage-backed securities and treasuries, originate mortgage-backed securities through GSEs, which are now in conservatorship, that have cost us $200 billion since 2006.
So it's funny, Steve, isn't it funny how he says type something on a typewriter?
Yeah.
I thought that was funny. That means go to the computer at the Fed and just create money out of thin air, of course.
Click, done.
Yeah, a couple of mouse clicks. And I've always wondered if that's a Mac or a PC. I'm just thinking it's a PC. But anyway.
Yeah.
And so create money out of thin air. And then he talks about the GSEs, the government-sponsored entities like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And they're basically insolvent. I mean, these are artificially low interest rates. What a great opportunity, because housing in the U.S. has been subsidized by the government since the Great Depression. So folks, remember that next time you ask me about international real estate investing and why I can't find a better deal anywhere else in the world, because we've got a special thing in the U.S. that is just different than other countries. And once again, believe me, I've looked, okay? I've looked. I'm speaking at a conference in Central America next month, and I know all of those people there, a lot of them will be Americans, are going to ask me about international real estate. And the U.S. just has a very favorable scenario as far as income property investing.
You're absolutely right, and people need to stop complicating it. It really is very simple. You can hear it in that commentator's voice on CNBC, where you know, he says, wait, you're talking about buying foreclosures and renting them? That's it? That's the trade of the century? Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is. Well, the trade of the past 20 years, and I think easily for the next 10 to 20 years, because regardless of what happens in the economy, you just know with the $60 to $120 trillion entitlement time bomb coming at us, the government's going to inflate their way out of the debt. There's like only three people that are saying this won't happen. out of there, it's like everybody else can just see the writing on the wall. One's Harry Dent and Bob Prechter. And then you get a couple of other of these economists that are really into the whole, oh, the government does a great job type of thing. The thing is, the likely story is we're going to have massive inflation.
And you've got the velocity of money people who think that, you know, well, the banks aren't doing anything with the money, therefore there won't be any inflation. But were they just going to do nothing perpetually?
They can't do. Money always comes off the sidelines. And that's what we've seen, by the way. We're seeing that right now. We've been seeing that for the past year and a half. Money does not want to rest. Money hates to rest. It hates to be sleepy. And that's why I say to our investors on a personal level, if you have equity in your home, you have sleepy money. You have lazy money. That money is doing nothing for you. This time of year, we're all getting these 1099 interest statements in the mail, right? Or 1098s do, showing what did our stock accounts do? How much money did our bank account pay us in interest? Well, that's like nothing. What did we make off these other investments? What do we have to report to the government, okay? Well, let me ask you this, listener. If you have equity in your house, did you get a 1099 statement showing the income you made from that equity? In other words, the metric that is used sometimes in commercial real estate called return on equity, I think that's a faulty metric. It doesn't really exist. Return on equity is not a real thing because the property will perform the same way in terms of price appreciation or depreciation, regardless of how much equity. And it will generate the same amount of gross income, regardless of the equity you have in the property. Okay? In fact, I say that it will produce more money in many cases if you have less equity, because when you have a higher payment, a higher debt service on that property, you're going to charge more on rent. You're going to be a better landlord. You're going to raise your rents more aggressively. Okay, so, you know, we've talked about this thing in past episodes, but let's get back to the video here, okay?
Just a reminder, you're listening to Flashback Friday. Our new episodes are published every Monday and every Wednesday.
In return, the GSEs go to originating banks and encourage them to originate single-family mortgages at low interest rates that can then be bundled into mortgage-backed securities and thus provide affordability to a homeowner, not the scarcity of housing, but the availability of credit. So home-building stocks have surged, and there's some great ones. Lennar, Toll, all of the big national home builders have benefited from deferred taxes, so they had big losses, or carrying those taxes forward, and from the current value of their unused inventory of lots, right? The manufacturing of a house is very simple. The creation of a lot is very complicated. So I think the market correctly has interpreted return to confidence. You have a couple million.
Let me just mention what I think he means by that. He says the manufacturing of the house is a relatively simple process, but the creation of a lot is a difficult process. You know what that means to me? That means that it is tough to get land entitled for development in many areas. And because there's all these hoops you have to jump through with governmental things, environmental impact reports, soil testing, you might have cleanup, you know, environmental cleanup that has to happen before you can build on the land. It might be an Indian burial ground. There's a zillion issues there with entitling this land. So the manufacturing of a lot, you know, being difficult, but then constructing the house isn't that difficult. However, with inflation, those building materials, they're going to go up in price. Steve, did you have any comments about that one?
I agree 100%. That's why, you know, when we're speculating, those developers, the people that take it from raw dirt to an entitled lot that can actually be built on, when we're talking about the flipping model, they're usually the ones that make most of the money because that process is so difficult there. And as you say, a lot of the times it's the environmental constraints that are pushing down that organic supply or that organic demand of people that really want to do it. So that's why in coastal areas, take San Francisco, for example. Many people speculate that that's where the bubble economy originated with, you know, heavy environmental influence, and it was artificially restricting the supply there. And so, but you look at the Dallas, Texas, there's land forever in every direction that is not so hard to entitle and get ready for a lot. And that's why the markets that we're in, like Dallas, have been historically a lot less volatile.
Yeah, a lot less risky because you don't have this phony government intervention in the marketplace. And I know all of the gamblers, they're thinking, listening to this right now, well, I want to invest in San Francisco because I can make big capital gains, or along the coastline of California. And look, I agree, you can. But show me someone who can reliably predict appreciation. And remember, the key to the game, and we're going to talk about this in a minute when we talk about the marriage issue. That's coming up in just a moment here. But the key to the game is staying power. And if you don't have staying power, you are ultimately going to pay the piper and you're going to get burnt. And I have seen it. Remember, my whole career as an investor and as a real estate agent is in Southern California, in these high-end markets like Irvine and Newport Beach. And I've made money in some, and I've had some close calls in others. And I used to be able to say, well, gosh, I never lost money in a real estate deal. And I probably still could actually say that. I'm not sure now. That's why I don't say it anymore. But I'm not totally sure. But when you really look at the multidimensional aspects of it, I'm not sure I've ever lost money in a real estate deal. If you're looking at it like a simpleton, you might think so. But when you look at all things considered, you know, you usually just make out pretty well on that real estate. But people that are investing for capital gains, yeah, they see these big price appreciates and they say, oh, the market's going crazy, I'm making a fortune. But what you didn't realize is that you were paying $2,000 or $3,000 a month in negative cash flow to carry that property during the time you speculated and it went up in value. And you didn't know it was going to go up in value. You got lucky. And I'll give it to you. I'd rather be lucky than good any day. But since I'm not always lucky, I'm just going to go with good. Okay?
Yeah. Good idea.
That's all we can bank on.
Yeah, it's a two-edged sword because the GSEs, like he's talking about, they're the ones that pump these bubbles up. And yeah, I guess in theory you can write them up, but you can just as easily write it down because you don't control it. It's phony supply and demand. It's not real.
It sure is. And that phony supply and demand is from environmental or governmental restrictions of some sort. Okay, let's finish up this video here.
Units a year of new housing that's needed for new housing formation. Forget about the demographics. You know, I have a 30-year-old home. He's not leaving the house. The combination of what's happening in housing is something else. But for sure, the lack of supply over the last 5 years has caused a demand where affordability because of subsidized credit from the government is once again causing the hope of every American saying, not that I need a roof over my head, but perhaps housing is a proxy for the creation of wealth that I'll never have in my job. So
just a quick question, Tom, in terms of like, because we were talking about the housing demand there, and you obviously are an investor and the houses have been going up. How much of that is attributed to investment demand versus real demand? Is that really true, masking the housing recovery?
I think the answer is yes and no. On the rental side, the acquisition of single family houses for sure has been done by some great firms.
Yeah.
Blackstone, Wayne Hughes, Chart Public Storage has a great vehicle. There's three or four great institutions who are buying. But housing has always been a debate between consumption and investment. Our government has said it's consumption, right? So in the CPI, you've got 43% of the CPI that's based on the rental value of housing. So I think investor phenomena has helped the economy because it's taken that shadow inventory out of the banks, along with regulatory capital rules. But for sure, along with that comes a resurgence of confidence. So Phoenix, home prices have gone up 22% in 12 months. Is that because we were all there buying? For sure. But there were only 50,000 housing units a year that the banks were producing to be bought. That produces some pressure on the individual who says, well, you know, I really want to buy a secondary house, and now I don't have the ability to do it.
So there you go. Really interesting stuff, huh?
Yeah, it's a very good point. How much of it is investor driven? Many of these big firms are doing this, but you know, they're not gonna
stay in it. that's still my prediction, folks.
I have it on good authority they're not. I actually, one that is buying some properties from our network was in town with a couple of our local market specialists yesterday, and they said very bluntly, "Yeah, we'll be here for 18 months. Then good luck to you." That's their plan.
Yeah, exactly. So the institutional investors, and you're representing a few of them in purchasing properties through our network, are just they're just not going to like this business.
<You know>? I don't think so.
It's too fragmented for them. Trust me, that's my prediction. They're going to mess it up. They're going to act like speculators. They're going to take their money and try and cash out while they can.
That's all they know how to do.
But the fact is, folks, people have bad credit nowadays and they need a place to live. And whenever you hear about shadow inventory, ask yourself the question, look, when a foreclosure occurs, that means someone became a renter. A renter was born that day when they moved out of that foreclosed property. So people only look at one side of that equation. They're so myopic. They think, oh, well, there's all this shadow inventory that's going to push prices down. Okay, maybe, but what's that person? There's someone's life that's being affected at every point there. That person has to go and rent something that's going to push rents up. Multi-dimensional asset class.
Yeah, it's and you know too, Jason, people are saying, well, there's less foreclosures. And I would submit that, well, that's because there's more short sales. Banks are figuring out that a short sale is a better way to liquidate these properties than to go all the way through the foreclosure process. And so when a short sale is completed, another renter is born. That person's not getting a mortgage either.
Well, one of the big things I said, and everybody seemed like they were predicting this wrongly, and I think, once again, I was one of the few voices out there that was saying it correctly, and that is that when people were talking about all of these adjustable rate mortgages, they were talking about this tidal wave of adjustable rate mortgages that were going to adjust because they knew the time they were going to adjust. And when they adjust, they thought, oh, there's going to be this massive foreclosure problem at that time. And that problem was far less severe than every other prognosticator, except I think yours truly, was saying, because they were looking at stats based on when those loans were originated. And they knew if they were a 3-year ARM or a 5-year ARM, adjustable rate mortgage, they knew when they would adjust. True. But what they didn't know is if the person had already sold the property, had already been foreclosed on before that, had already done a short sale before that, had already done a loan modification before that. No one was counting that. And that's exactly what you're saying, is there's a mitigation factor that happens to shadow inventory. And that was part of the shadow inventory call. And it was never as big a deal as everybody said because of the reasons I just mentioned. Nobody accounted for the preemptive mitigation issue. That's what we'll call it, the preemptive mitigation issue. And that's what happened in real life.
Right, right. And plus two, and real quick comment, an article by Mr. Durden today talks about that, how the banks too have less of an incentive to push out the shadow inventory now, because by artificially restricting it, they're getting more for what they do have out there, which sort of solves their reserves requirement. And they don't have to, you know, it's this cycle. They don't have to bleed it out as fast anymore. They are withholding it on purpose, knowing that what's out there will climb in value due to the increased competition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good point. Well, that's the fictitious Mr. Durden who writes on Zero Hedge, Tyler Durden, the character from the movie Fight Club. Okay, hey, we got to talk about this marriage thing real quickly. I'm single. You're married. It's Valentine's Day. So here we go. Why married people tend to be wealthier? It's complicated. and this is an article from Today, which is the NBC show, but of course they have a website. And it's an article posted on there about 24 hours ago. And I just thought this was kind of interesting because I generally think they're right. I generally think that couples are wealthier than single people. And there are some interesting factors that come into play there. What was your take on the article, Steve?
Well, I thought it was, you know, a pretty interesting point. But, you know, you're apparently going to be four times wealthier than a single person if you are happily married. And that's the key.
Big contingency there. Happily,
yeah,
is the key word.
Yeah. So, yeah, don't just go, you know, go to Vegas and ink a deal and magically think, oh, four times wealthier. There's a plenty of work that goes into that four times wealthier, believe me.
Yeah, and, so, and what's interesting is these things are never as they seem on the surface. And as we were chatting about the article off air, one of the things I said is I think that generally married people just feel more pressure because they might be planning on children, so they're working harder. They think, well, gosh, I'm going to have some big obligations coming up, or if they already have children, they're thinking, you know, college obligation, which college, I'm telling you folks, go on YouTube and Google the movie, or just Google the movie. It's a little documentary called The College Conspiracy. College is largely a ripoff. It's not what it used to be. Another discussion, we've talked about it, but they think, well, if they're with no kids, they think, well, you know, we've got to work really hard because we're going to have kids. If they already have kids, we got to work really hard because we've got college or possible expenses or medical expenses or whatever it is. So I think generally speaking, that's one of the reasons. But you know, Steve, I always say in my seminars when I do the Creating Wealth Boot Camp, I always say that the biggest destroyer of wealth, it's the D word. It's divorce. That's what really kills it for most people. So try and stay married. It's an important deal. If you're married, if you want to have financial success, a big part of that financial success is avoiding divorce.
Yeah, it is. And I think going back to what you're saying about pressure, I mean, it's kind of funny. I think back to when I was single and I kind of wonder, you know, what was I doing all the time? Because, you know, I have to be much more efficient. Now, I know you're an exception. You know, stare out your window at the ASU co-eds and it takes up a lot of your time.
Well, so, you know, yeah, that's another good point. Being single is, well, I don't know. I've never been married. I'd like to be married. But being single is a lot of work. It's like a lot of your thoughts and life are spent in trying to find that special person, right? And I mean, yeah, there's a lot of gorgeous girls here at ASU, but they're a little young for me.
But, really? I didn't know that.
Well, you know, yeah, all right, another discussion for another show. But it seems like it's a lot of work, you know? Now, I don't know, being married is a lot of work too. I guess it takes a lot of time.
Well, yeah, but the article points out, because you're right, you know, you're single, it's taking up all this time, that's opportunity cost, right?
Yeah, right.
We're making this a really geeky subject, but it's time that you could be spending on making money, for example. And the article talks about that, where when you're married, a husband, for example, he could afford to go to work for 12 hours a day because A, he doesn't have to court anybody. He has to court his wife a little bit still if he wants to stay married. That's a side point.
Yeah, right.
But
true.
He doesn't have to court anybody, and he doesn't have to go home and do all the household stuff that he normally would have to do. It allows each to to kind of specialize. And by you both doing that, you're both better off. Kind of a weird spinoff to the economist David Ricardo, who talked about specialization.
Specialization of labor is what really advances an economy. If someone is a great baker and someone's a great candlestick maker, you know, obviously,
yeah, there you
this
go.
Is not the high-tech world in which we live, but it's just a saying. They're going to specializing, they're going to make a better product for a lower price, and everybody's going to have more stuff and more wealth and a higher standard of living. So specialization is important, and couples that work well as a team, they really do specialize.
Yeah, definitely. Wow, we really made that whole marriage thing geeky and have applied economics into it, and leave it to us to do that.
Happy Valentine's Day, everybody. We took all the romantical side out of it. And I know romantical is not a word, but my ex-girlfriend used to say that one all the time. And I always thought it was cute, you know. Oh, you're being so romantical. It's a great word. It's a great fake word. Anyway, okay. Anything else on this topic before we get to our guest?
Well, I guess you weren't being romantical enough because she's your ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes that's better. One of the best ways to avoid divorce is to stay unmarried. Then you can be 100% sure, but that's kind of a bad philosophy because it's like saying you'll miss 100% of the shots you don't take as a golfer, right?
Divorce's form of abstinence.
Yeah, there you go. You know, I don't know. The jury is obviously out on this subject. It's been out for since the beginning of time.
Not coming out with a verdict anytime soon.
Yeah, no, it's you know, different situations and different strokes for different folks. But hey, I want to on a serious note here before we get to our guest, we're going to do something. We've got a couple really interesting episodes coming up on the show here. And one of them is we're going to do a comparison. We're going to analyze rate of return when a deal goes bad. And it kind of alludes to what I said a few minutes ago when we were playing that video, because even when a deal goes bad, it's many times a lot better than you think. And I have often said that many income property investors are winning the game and they don't even realize they're winning the game because they don't know how to properly keep score. And we're going to talk about that. We're going to look at performas. I'm really excited about this show, okay, that's coming up. We're going to look at performas for the medium case scenario, which is the one you'll see on the jasonhartman.com website. The best case scenario, which is what if it goes better than expected, and then a worst case scenario where you've got a lot more vacancy, more repair cost, you know, maybe an eviction, where things just are not going well, and you think, gosh, I am losing my shirt in this deal. But, you know, you might be surprised. It might be better than you think. So we're going to look at the actual nerdy, geeky numbers, okay? And then we're going to look at the math and how those rates of returns are. Steve, you did some research on this for that episode that we'll have coming up on this. Did you have any quick comments on that?
Well, these are single-family properties, and they're very inexpensive. So small changes to monthly income or expense can really swing that ROI. But like you say, if it's a big hassle, if it's a pain, many times you're still coming out ahead or even better to these other traditional investments. And if you get, say, a multi-year tenant that signs a two-year lease and a few other things break your way, your return just becomes astronomical.
Yeah, or if you're like my mom, who's had the same tenant in one of her properties since 1989, we had her on a prior show talking about that. Or if you're like me, who had a tenant in one of his properties for 9 years, raising the rent all along, and the guy finally, after 9 years, moved. So the two things are, life is a marathon, not a sprint. That's number one. And number two is that the question of a lifetime, okay, we talked about the trade of the decade. Well, here's the question of a lifetime. Compared to what? Compared to what? You got to always ask yourself, compared to what? And then I think you'll be pretty impressed with income property done properly, even when things don't go so well. So we're going to do that on a future episode. Hey, Steve, we got to wrap this up because we got to get to our 10th show guest here. Thanks for joining me. Let's go to our guest. Let's talk about soft addictions, and we'll be right back with that in just a moment.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn about investing in and managing income properties for college students, there's a show for that. If you want to learn how to get noticed online and in social media, there's a show for that. If you want to know how to save on life's largest expense, there's a show for that. And if you'd like to know about America's crime of the century, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. only from jasonhartman.com, or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
My pleasure to welcome Dr. Judith Wright to the show. She is the author of a few books, but one of them is The Soft Addiction Solution: Break Free of Seemingly Harmless Habits That Keep You from the Life You Want, and also her newest work, which is Transformed: The Science of Spectacular Living. And she's coming to us today from Chicago. Judith, how are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Good. Well, pleasure to have you on the show. And we talked for just a couple of moments before we started. And I find the topic of soft addictions to be a very catchy and fascinating idea. And you'll explain it, of course, but what I gather is that you're talking about things that aren't seemingly very harmful. I mean, they're not a drug addiction. They're not something that will necessarily ruin one's life, per se, but they are, at the very least, maybe robbing us of time, aren't they?
I think it's well put. I coined the term soft addiction because they have that addictive quality like drugs or alcohol, but the substances themselves don't kill you. However, at the same time, you don't really die from soft addictions, but you don't really live either, because it's those seemingly harmless habits that we all do, that we so often overdo these normal everyday activities, whether it's checking your Facebook page, your email, social media, over shopping, overeating, being too consumed with sports, but it can be any normal everyday activity, but you're overdoing it, oftentimes not realizing the cost that it has, both in time, money, but it also mutes our consciousness. It numbs our feelings. It's actually robbing us from a greater sense of satisfaction and from what we could be using those resources for instead. They have a much greater cost than we're aware of because they're so pervasive. We just think it's normal.
Okay, so let me play devil's advocate with that for a moment. So let's take social media, which is all the rage nowadays.
Right.
So it's a different way of communicating for sure. But would you say that before the advent of social media, that spending time with one's friends or chatting with them on the phone is a soft addiction? I mean, what's really the difference besides the medium than, you know, talking to them on Facebook, for example?
Well, I think it's a good point. I think mankind has had soft addictions forever before media was even invented. It might have been that it was daydreaming or other kinds, overworking or things that we get lost in. So, but I do think that things have sped up and it's become increasingly much easier to get addicted with all the changes in technology and the new things and our disposable income. And there's lots of things that contribute to that. And the quality of, you know, we all want to connect, we want to relate, we want to belong, and it's not like we're going to get rid of social media or computers or televisions or anything, but how do we use them? Because the quality of contact that we have on Facebook isn't the same as face-to-face. It's fine for exchanging some information, catching up a little bit, but when we're using that to substitute for deep, intimate, personal contact with our friends and family members, where you can read each other's facial cues, you can have the power of your social, emotional intelligence really engaged, we're missing out on a quality of human relationship that has a huge cost to us.
Fair enough, and I agree, but just playing devil's advocate for another moment, isn't that what maybe all the naysayers said when the telephone came out?
Well, I think they probably did with every new media, and I don't think that they were totally wrong, but there's also, there's a good side and a bad side. This is what's so insidious about soft addictions, because with drugs or alcohol, you don't need those to live, but in our modern society, you're going to be eating, and then there's a propensity to overeat. You're going to use your computer, and you can overuse it. You're going to have social media, but you can overuse it. So you can't get rid of, nor should we get rid of, the positive uses of these things, but when they're running us, and we're at the effect of that, that we aren't in charge of it, that it has an addictive, compulsive way of pulling us out of our everyday reality, then that's where it becomes a problem.
And, you know, I would say the same thing is true with materialism, and you alluded to it, and I want to ask you to kind of help ferret that out for us. But things are fine. It's great to have things, but we just got to make sure that we're the master and the things don't end up owning us, so we're the servant. So how does one know when it's running us, as you say? When is it an addiction? I mean, I assume this is, it's got several shades of gray in here. It's not a black and white answer, is it?
No, I don't think it is, but I think it's something. Sometimes you just know. You know, I'm feeling a little guilty about this. I'm spending too much time on this. I'm spending too much money. I'm avoiding some things. Some part of you oftentimes is conscious that it's too much. But sometimes other people are mad at you about it or teasing you about it or really resenting the time and energy you're spending away from them. That's another signal. But another is, how do you feel when you're doing it? If you're doing engaging, if you're over shopping or doing too much media or whatever that is, if you're kind of buzzed or high or agitated or kind of cloudy, foggy, a little out of it, a little in a trance, if you've got that that surfing the web voice, that uh-huh, you know, that dead kind of disconnected quality, or if you've done something and you can't remember really even what you did or what you ate or what you spent, or you end up buying the same pair of shoes you already have, those kinds of things let you know you're not with it. You're not all there. So chances are that's a soft addiction. On the other hand, if you're engaging in something and you feel more present, more grounded, more alive, you're learning something, you're growing, you feel expanded, then chances are that's a passion. But we shouldn't confuse the two and pretend that soft addictions are a passion when they're really an altered state.
It is an altered state. It's like the video game concept where it puts people into the alpha state. And maybe the brain waves are different with these different soft addictions, but conceptually, it's kind of the same thing. It's kind of trance in a way, isn't it?
Well, and I think that's a problem because it takes us out of ourselves. And then sometimes what we do with our friends and family is we do soft addictions together. We think we're having a good time. And there's something, we're having a parallel play activity maybe, but we're not connecting. And the neuroscience underneath it is really interesting, because what happens is that the soft addictions are more fueled by the neurotransmitter of dopamine, which obviously sounds like dope, but it's what gets you, we need it, it gets you motivated, it has you take action, it's one of the pleasure centers of our brain. But there's no real satisfaction with that. It's just a buzz, it's kind of a high, it's addictive in its way. What we've learned in our research, and part of what we've got into our new book, Transformed, about the science of spectacular living, is that there's another pleasure center of the brain, and this is what we're avoiding when we get to our soft addictions. And it's fueled by the neurotransmitters of opioid, which of course sounds like opium, but what it really is, that's that state of bliss, that place where you get that satisfied pause, where it goes, oh, this feels good. There's a sense of fulfillment or satisfaction. But when those two centers compete, that wanting center, the cravings, that part of us wants a soft addiction, always wins, unless we can really train ourselves to really go for those things that I call our deeper yearnings, that really fulfill us and satisfy us, that are fueled by a whole other pleasure center of our brains that really make us feel satisfied and fulfilled. And I don't think we should, you know, just get high when we have the opportunity to really be satisfied and fulfilled and love our lives. That's a much greater reward for our activity.
Yeah, rather than just the transitory reward, it can be a much deeper thing. You talk about the why, and I think that is such an important issue in human motivation, is the why. You talk about cracking your own code. Tell us about discovering the why.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we don't just wake up in the morning and say, oh, I hope I overeat today and bite my nails and lose tons of hours of social media. You know, it's not usually what we consciously want. But there's triggers that we have. There's coping mechanisms we've developed over time. There's patterns of behavior that we have that become kind of a part of our lifestyle. We don't really notice that. For me, I was an overeater. I was fat, and I was a chubby kid. So I had this pattern of when I was upset, or when I didn't know that consciously, but when I was sad or angry or afraid and I didn't know how to deal with those feelings, if there's things I couldn't stomach, I literally would just eat to kind of quell that. Well, whatever that upset was, and that became a pattern for me. So part of it was, for me, like, I would notice it as an adult. I realized I'd be out on a date with a guy when I was dating, and all of a sudden I realized, wow, I've eaten the entire bread basket. And like, what's going on? And when I looked at that, I said, you know, I'm uncomfortable with this guy, and I'm nervous. I don't like how he's treating me. I don't like how he just treated the waitress. And rather than being in touch with my upset, I'm stuffing it with bread. When I started to realize that things like that, I said, whoa, there's way better ways for me to be able to deal with these things. So understanding what your triggers are and what the emotions are that are kind of triggering the behavior can help you then deal with those in a better way.
Give us an example for someone as it might relate, because, and I, you know, I don't mean to make this the topic, but it's such the current thing, is it might relate to social media. What would be the why there? Need for belonging, need for self-expression? Is someone deficient in that in their life, and that's why they're looking for that reward online? Or I mean, those are just what I kind of came up with as you were
talking.
Those
are great, great guesses, and I think they're really apt. Because what we found under every soft addiction, every craving, every want, is a deeper yearning. And then also when we did the research for Transformed, our new book, we realized that people who live we study people who live really great lives, really have a sense of satisfaction in their lives and their careers and their relationships, their leadership expands. There's just that this beautiful quality of their life. And we found that they led their lives by these yearnings. It's what our research kept revealing. So what you're seeing is that under every craving, there's a deeper yearning. So if it's social media, you want to check your Facebook page. You want to check your email. You want to just see who just posted or whatever. It's almost Pavlovian in responses that you have. But under that, there's a deeper yearning. And it's a deeper yearning to connect. It's a deeper yearning to belong, perhaps, or to feel like you matter, or to know that you're important, or that you're part of something. Those yearnings are pure and beautiful, and every human being has those. But we can't really get those yearnings fully met by Facebook. It just gives us a little bit of a high. It doesn't really feed that yearning, although we keep going to it hoping that we'll get more satisfied, but it never really completes itself until we really have more face-to-face contact, when we really can make a phone call or see a smile on a loved one's face or go for a walk and play and really greet people and feel that kind of connection. Those kinds of things give us that, really meet that deeper yearning. So when we can use our soft addictions to help us identify what those deeper yearnings are, because we can translate those surface cravings to what is it we're really hoping that would give to us. And once we know that yearning, we can go about meeting that in much more satisfying ways. And people that live great lives, that's exactly what they do.
It's like selling your dreams for small desires, isn't it?
Oh, beautifully put. It is that. And the small desires, we hope that they'll make us happy. We hope that'll make us be fulfilled. But it's really only our deeper dreams and our beautiful, pure yearnings that will do that. But the other part about the deeper yearnings, you know, there's something about soft addictions. They're so accessible. You can grab a donut pretty quickly and get on Facebook pretty easily. But also yearnings can be met really easily also, because if you do yearn to connect, there's a lot of ways to do that. You can make a phone call. You can even text someone with a little more. You can use the media if you know that you're really using it for a deeper connection and share more fully, be more open, be more honest, be more vulnerable, be more truthful in a way that helps that be a deeper connection. And then in the moment, it's really fulfilling.
Yeah, and you know what? You can even do that on, for example, Facebook, since we're talking about it, because I heard this. Oh, you know, Judith, can you hang on just a moment?
Sure.
I've got to check my Facebook. I'm joking.
Right there, caught.
Yeah. But I heard a study just, two weeks ago about how people that look at Facebook, they're not as satisfied with their life.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that's true. I tell you, I felt that way myself, because you look at your news feed and it's like almost 95% of what you see, and it depends on the person because everybody's feed is different. But what you see is positive stuff, that someone's got this great thing going, or they're having fun, or they've got these great pictures, and you're thinking we're always doing it. This is just human nature. You know, we're always comparing and we're always judging, and we're saying, well, why isn't my life that good? Why aren't I in Europe?
Yeah, right. you know? Feel jealous, competitive, and bad about yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I think, you know, it's true. I realized with myself early on, I was softly addicted to magazines and catalogs. Mm-hmm. And I realized that as I picked up a catalog or a magazine, I didn't feel good. I felt worse after reading them or looking at them, because like in a magazine, same thing. I was comparing myself to all these things and didn't have that ideal.
Well, the perfect images, and that's a concept that's pretty interesting. I remember hearing about a long, long time ago, and that was saying that males in our population are dissatisfied because they suffer from something called centerfold syndrome, which is where, you know, all of the women you see in the media are airbrushed and beautiful and perfect. And, you know, in real life, it's not like that.
You know? Yeah, human beings aren't photoshopped. You know, there we are in all of our ruggedness. And there is this kind of idea that you keep comparing yourself, or in that case, other people or women too, that can't measure up. And you end up feeling worse. The same thing with Facebook. If you keep comparing yourself for seeing that, because people aren't using Facebook oftentimes for the real deeper truth. We're protecting our images and trying to sell what's cool or what's good about us. And it's not that depth of connection. There's an unreality sometimes about it. And that's where a great heart-to-heart conversation with people really sharing their hopes and their dreams and their fears and their challenges and their successes is so much more satisfying because it's real and it's deeper and you're connecting at a much more intimate level. It's very fulfilling.
Right. So this sort of begs the question, is it better to have a lot of friends, and I'm saying that in quote, in the Facebook sense or the acquaintance sense, or is it better to have just a very small number as you would in the old days because you were limited by geography and lack of telecommunication, just a few close friends? And I know where everybody's mind goes with that immediately. Everybody's going to say, well, it's better to have a few close friends, and I bet you are too. But the one thing you do have some benefits of having this broad, big pool of friends. Seems like, I don't know what the average is, but everybody on, say, Facebook has a few hundred friends. Now, five of those or three of them are close friends, but that you really
well,
do things
you
with.
You know, that's a really good question. I think, actually, though, that there's uses for both. It's not one or the other, because close friends, people that know you, people that you know, that you're supporting one another, you're empowering one another, it's truthful. You know they're there for you in good times and bad, that people that you can reach out to, people that can give you honest feedback, encourage you, let you know when you need to get your button gear. All those things are extremely helpful. And the only way, and people who live great lives have these kind of great life team members. It's what our research showed as well. So that's really helpful. At the same time, the bigger your network of a more genuine way, when you're the hub of a network and you have a lot of people and resources, those are resources. If you have a question, you can get it answered more easily. If you need a referral to someone who's really great at something, the bigger your network is, the more people that you trust, you can get that kind of information. So a network can help you expand your influence and also bring you more resources. And you need people that you can be close to. You know, and I think part of it maybe rests with each of us. How genuine are we with the people that we're with, whether it's a few or a lot? The more real we are, if it's 100 people or 10 people, we're still going to have that depth of connection. And maybe that's the critical factor.
Well, I'm looking for a new blog post by you with the top 10 deep, meaningful, vulnerable Facebook status updates.
I love it. I think there's something to that.
Yeah, there you go. That will really inspire deep connections in a modern media format.
Well, and I think there's something to that. You know, and I ask people about that. Oh, I'm so afraid if I did that, then people make fun of me, or that they'll think I'm being kind of weird, or that it's too vulnerable. And at the same time, shouldn't we feel funny about some of the stuff we are posting? It's not all that great.
It's certainly questionable. That's open to debate, no question about it. Judith, tell us about the math of more. I think in Western cultures, especially with thanks to Madison Avenue, it seems like life is just about more, more, more. More of everything. It's like the collector's morality and mentality. What do you mean by the math of more?
Well, it's a good question because I usually capitalize it so you understand, wait, the big more of life as opposed to the little more of life. Because the math of more is interesting because when I was doing the research and looking at soft addictions, what I realized is that we're already feeling deprived. And so to try to take away our soft addictions feels really threatening. I mean, none of us wants to let go of our little friends or candy or whatever that is metaphorically for us. So just subtracting wasn't really the answer, and it wasn't the answer for me in my life, that we really need to add things to our lives that meet these deeper yearnings. And when we do that, it's much easier to subtract our soft addictions because the needs are met. They're fulfilled. Our cravings just kind of go away. And that's what's really interesting. So the math of more is adding things that meet your deeper yearnings and subtracting some of the overindulging. And that actually then multiplies the pleasure and satisfaction you're getting in your life. So it's not a path of deprivation. It's a path of really adding to your life what really satisfies you.
So in a moment, I want to jump to the next step of maybe considering that soft addictions is the problem, then I want to talk about spectacular living and transformation. But before we do that, could you please cover the four loving truths?
The four loving truths are something that are really quite profound and something that happens when you live these ways, and they actually kind of help you with that. The first loving truth is you are loved. Now, whether you feel it or believe it, to live with that reality that I'm loved, whether I feel it or not, and looking for evidence of that love in your life, whether that's a waitress remembering what you ordered to drink and bringing it to you, or a smile on the street, or a close loved one, to really live with the truth that you're loved. And another loving truth is, which is about your emotions. And one is that love and peace are the legacy of your pain. So many of us think that, oh, my pain is a problem and I have to numb that in order for me to feel love or peace. And it's actually the opposite. If we can allow ourselves to express our pain, to cry that out, to let that go, then it's followed very naturally by love and peace. So if we deny our pain, we're denying the love and the peace we can get. Another loving truth is also related to emotions, but that our feelings are divine and to be honored, rather than to be numbed or suppressed, to really bring our emotions up to the surface and to really understand the beautiful information they have for us, how they make us more real, how they help us connect and love and be loved, and how precious they really are, and the importance of our emotional intelligence and our hearts. And the fourth loving truth is that gifts are given to us, every single human being, to develop and utilize in the divine symphony of life. And every single one of us has talents and gifts, maybe even yet undiscovered or undeveloped, but they're there. And the more we engage in life more fully, we can discover what those are, develop those, and use those. And if every human being is doing that and offering their gifts, we have a beautiful symphony of life. And I don't have to have your gifts, and you don't have my gifts. We're all offering them to this beautiful symphony of life. And those are the four loving truths.
Fantastic. Before we leave the soft addictions subject, I want to ask you about one that is encouraged and that is seemingly very good, and maybe you can address it, and that is exercise. Can exercise be a soft addiction or maybe a hard addiction? I don't know.
It actually can. There's many people that are over-addicted to whether it's the runner's high or whatever that is, but they're overworking out, and there's many whys to it, trying to get a sense of control in their life, being over-concerned about their health or their bodies or their weight or how they look or whatever. But people can get really lost in overdoing exercise. Of course, exercise is a good thing, but you can really get addicted to overworking out. And I know many people who have done that and have worked on that, they still work out, but it no longer has that obsessive quality for them.
So the endorphins can be certainly addictive, right? And that's the runner's
high. Literally, because you're getting that kind of high from it, and you can get hooked by it. But almost anything can become a soft addiction. I know people that have got softly addicted to meditation or even prayer, and that's they're both beautiful things. But if you're overusing it, and one woman, she told me she was addicted to prayer. I said, how is that possible? What is that? What would happen is anytime anything would happen, she would go pray rather than deal with it. She wouldn't talk to her husband. She wouldn't speak up at work. She just would go to prayer. So she was caught in a bind rather than prayer in addition to doing what she needed to do. And she realized she was using it as an escape. So anything you're overdoing and using to escape from other parts of your life, chances are it's a soft addiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe the balance there is God helps those who help themselves to some extent. There's a point to that.
There's a both and with that.
We'll be back in just a minute.
You know, Penny, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Rich. Jason actually has a 6-book set on creating wealth that comes with over 100 hours of the most comprehensive ideas on investing in business. They're in high-quality digital download audio format, ready for your car, iPod, or wherever you want to learn.
Yes, and by the way, he's recently added another book to the series that shows you investing the way it should be. This is a world where anything less than a 26% annual return is disappointing.
Jason actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets that are untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I like how he teaches us how to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
He's recorded interviews with Harry Dent, Peter Schiff, Robert Kiyosaki, Pat Buchanan,
Catherine Austin Fitz, Dr. Dennis Waitley, T. Harv Eker, and so many others who are experts on the economy, on real estate, and on creating wealth.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered with a savings of $385.
Now, to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series complete with over 100 hours of audio and 6 books, go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you.
Well, let's talk about the science of spectacular living transformed. A lot of great stuff in this book, and you go through some different steps and so forth. You start where you like.
Great. Well, what happened? Transformed is an amazing thing. What we did was we studied people who are living great lives. We started with some of our students at Wright. We have coaching and training and seminars that people do, and everybody learns and grows, but some people were blowing the doors off of their lives. Their relationships were deep and intimate and satisfying. They're getting promoted. They're making more money. Their sales were escalating. Their leadership is going amazingly well. And the parenting was so deeply satisfying. We go, wait a minute, what are they doing differently? And we studied what we call those positive deviants that were doing similar things but getting much greater results. And Jersey, what are they doing differently? They're in the same classes, they're seeing the same coaches. What is that? And we found that there was as we did the research on that, there was a process, there were 6 phases of this process that they engaged in, of consciously engaging in their own transformation in a different way. And when we studied then people in history and currently are heroes and heroines, we realize that they're living the same way. And then we saw that current neuroscience and behavioral economics, all kinds of science backs it up. And we said, wait a minute, we're onto something. And that's what we put into this book, Transformed. And one of the first phases we've actually been talking about, that all these people who lead these really satisfying, spectacular lives really base their lives on their yearning. They're very in touch with their yearning to love and be loved, to matter, to make a difference, to touch and be touched, to be seen, to be heard. And they allow that to guide their lives into engaging, which is the second phase, and really engaging in activities and ways of being and living their lives more adventurously, being willing to take risks and make mistakes, which leads them into the next 4 phases. It's a phenomenal way of living, and it's available for all of us.
Yeah, wow. When you look at what really, I mean, how do you, first of all, quantify, I guess I'd just call it fulfillment? I mean, how do you know? You know, like I've read these studies about how the richest countries or the richest societies aren't necessarily the most fulfilled. But then I've read other studies that say, you know, can money buy happiness? And I'm just using money as an example because it's hard to quantify fulfillment. That's what I'm getting to here. But I remember reading one that was very interesting, the old thing of can money buy happiness? And they found, and of course you'd have to adjust this for inflation, which would be pretty significant because I read this in the, I think, the early to mid-90s. And it was a study that showed that for an American, and depending on where you live, if you live in an expensive place, then adjust up. If you live in a low cost of living place, you can probably adjust down a little bit. And then, of course, you got to adjust for 18, 20 years of inflation. But the number, there was a number they put to it in this study. And they said it was about a net worth of about $1.5 million.
Wow.
Was the number. And so, you know, adjusting that for inflation, that's probably $3.5 million today. But they found that that number, you didn't need more than that. But if you had that much, it really did make one's life happier because they felt free. They didn't feel like they had to worry. And that's can be very negative, certainly. But how do you quantify fulfillment? Just by what people tell you? I mean, God, if you look at my Facebook feed, everybody looks like they're having a great life.
Yeah, right.
Just clearly. To tie back into the old conversation.
Good marketing or PR for it anyway, but we don't know. And it's interesting, you know, I don't know. The more recent studies I've read on money, for example, if we use that one again, really don't show those kind of differences, even across the world and cross-culturally, unless you're below poverty. And then if you get up to at least right at that level, if your family of 4, if you get up to $40,000, then you're happier if you've been below that, which makes sense. But after that, there's really not that much difference, which is really interesting. Now, I think the key thing you're saying in the research that you were talking about is that people felt free. But we don't have to wait to be free till we have $3 million. Freedom is something we can choose now, no matter how much money or little money or whatever we have.
Right.
And when we do that, when we start to orient toward, or why do we want money? What do we hope it would provide for us? Freedom might be one. That might be a deeper yearning to be free. For others, it's the yearning to feel like they matter or that they're important or a yearning for security. And when we know why we want those things and we actually go for it directly, that's what actually causes more of the fulfillment. And ironically, what happens when, and what we saw in our research, the more that you're following these deeper yearnings, whether it's to matter or to be seen or to heard or to be respected, you end up achieving way more goals, because it's really something, because the way that you're living your life tends to be you're more you, you're more authentic, you're more connected with other people, you tend to be more productive, you're more satisfied, you're making a bigger difference, and many things happen out of that. You shift yourself kind of from the inside out, and ironically, you make more money. I mean, all the people in our study made more money. They weren't trying to make more money per se. They were leading a great life and focusing on their yearnings, but it naturally led to making more money. But it wasn't the money that made them happy. They went about being happy, and then they made more money.
Yeah, absolutely. And probably either they were doing something that they were passionate about and that had an impact on making them happy, or they brought a happy person to the table and suddenly what they were doing became filled with passion and interest.
Well, and oftentimes it's the second thing you mentioned that we saw more than anything else, because most people have like a magical solution. If I just had something I was passionate about,
right,
then I'd be happy. No, invest yourself fully where you are. And all of a sudden, this so-called boring job or bad situation becomes much more interesting. You start growing more. You start naturally expanding, getting promoted or outgrowing that in a natural way and going to the next thing, and the universe kind of responds to you. So it's bringing that happier, more fulfilled, engaged. And that's where that second phase, engaging, is so important with our study. Really engaging, because most people are kind of checked out or waiting for something else to happen or waiting to win the lottery or waiting till they get a new job or waiting till the economy recovers, rather than engaging fully in their yearnings right now. And when you do that, you have instant fulfillment. Maybe it takes you a longer time to actually reach some goals, but you don't have to wait till the goal is met to be satisfied. So it's long-term results, but in the moment, it's much more fulfilling.
Yeah, it sure is. The problem with Westernized culture, and this may be true in other cultures as well, is that we've got this media that is so omnipresent in all of our lives, and it's constantly telling us. It's the subtext of virtually all media is more, more, more.
Right, and there's something wrong with you, and here, we'll fix it with this, buy this, do this, get this.
Right, and so I just translate that into more. There's lack.
Yep, no, it's all about lack.
It's point out a lack, and then point out how your product or service can fill that.
Well, it's an effective marketing strategy, obviously,
but it doesn't
work for fulfillment. You know, the third phase in our study, these people are living these spectacular lives, was once they're yearning and engaging more fully and living more adventurously, the next thing that oftentimes happens is what we call revelating. You start to become more aware of the forces that are influencing your decisions. You start to realize what we call your matrix, that all the neural pathways that are the basis of your belief systems about yourself and the world, and you start to reflect differently. So, for example, many people, we all have core mistaken beliefs about ourselves and the world. There's some part of it that feels like we're not enough, or we're not okay, or we're not lovable, or we're too much, or something like that for all of us. But let's say that is your core mistaken belief, and you start, in the revelating, you start to realize, wow, I really think I'm not enough. Well, that makes me susceptible to those ads. And then I think, oh, then if I just bought this or got more, did this, I'd be okay. But maybe it's my belief that's really at issue, and I can work at changing that. And that's part of what leads to the next phases, which is liberating, taking action in ways that are counter to those different mistaken beliefs and limiting beliefs that we have. And then rematrixing, which is literally changing the neural pathways of our brain, changing that matrix. So we're thinking differently, our behaviors are different, our emotions are different, we're becoming someone different. And finally, it's sixth phase is dedicating, really dedicating ourselves to consciously engaging in our own transformation and our evolution, which keeps us living this way all the time rather than thinking, oh, if I just achieve this goal, then I can coast. No, let me make my life about becoming what we call a transformer. Someone who's always learning and growing and discovering new things, becoming someone I haven't even imagined becoming yet. And that's where the real thrill of living takes place. And that's what we found.
Really amazing. So those core beliefs are so important, aren't they? And if you look at it, I think of, you know, when you were talking about that, it made me think of gangs, for example. And the people they look for, and the people that con artists look for, and the people that drug dealers look for, and are the people who are that have this sense of lack, that have this sense that they don't belong, that they're outcast, and that's when you become very susceptible to all of these different things, don't you?
Well, it's really true, and I think there's a level of that for everyone. At some, you know, that's more severe or more susceptible for some, but there's always a nagging part of each of us. It's just a natural course of our own development when you understand how our neural pathways are laid down and how experiences lead us to those kinds of beliefs. You start to understand the universality of that. But if deep at the core, and you're not conscious of it, you don't know that's necessarily what you believe, but you really, if you don't believe that you're okay, or you're not lovable, or that you're too much, or not enough, or something's wrong with you, or whatever that is, it makes you very susceptible to wanting to belong to things that aren't even that good for you, or being in relationships that aren't great for you. And until we understand that those beliefs, it's true that we believe them, but it's not true about our human worth, that we're all loved and adorable when we have responsibility to make ourselves more that way, that we all matter, that we all have worth, until we really can shift those beliefs and shift our behaviors, we can overcome that susceptibility, but we have to be aware of what it takes to really change that. And just saying a simple affirmation isn't enough. We literally have to use our neuroplasticity, which is a plastic part of our brains, and really repeated efforts to really change that essential programming. But it is doable, and it's kind of thrilling that we can, but we can't kid ourselves. It's hard work, and it takes a lot of time and repetition, but the results are worth it.
I mean, is it possible for everybody? Why do some people struggle with success or transformation or the science of spectacular living or fulfillment, whatever you want to call it? I mean, it just begs the question, is it really possible for everybody? Because is it that some people just haven't been coached right, or they're not willing to delay gratification for bigger rewards? What is it? You talk about the heart of transformation.
Right. Well, the heart of transformation is really being able to live from your heart and really use your emotions and your emotional intelligence and develop that, because it is one of the keys to really living a beautiful, satisfying life. We don't do it in spite of our emotions. We do it through our emotions. But I think part of what it is there's so much misinformation about what it really takes to change. And most people change their minds, but they don't change their brains. And until we really change our brains, we're not going to substantially change. It won't. And if we do, it doesn't last. And there's so much all this hype about quick fixes, you know, oh, just do this quick fix, 3 days, 10 days, three steps. It doesn't work that way. When you really understand how the brain works, you realize there's no such thing as a quick fix. And what happens is when we think, oh, there is, and then we try that and it doesn't work, we start to get discouraged. We start to think there's no solution out there, or there's something wrong with us, that we can't make this happen or can't make it stick. We really get discouraged. But it's really that the technology hasn't been available to people. It's available, but people haven't known exactly what it takes. And it does take a lot. It's just like you want to learn a musical instrument. You don't just read a book about it or do a weekend on it. You have to do a ton of practice of the right kind to really become proficient. Well, spectacular living is the same way. You need to know what the phases are, the stages of it, what to do first, and little tiny steps that build on little tiny steps that keep over time work and repeatedly. But there is a technology to it, and it's available to anyone. Anybody can live a great life if they're willing to do the work that it takes to do that. And the work that it takes is really fulfilling, too, because you're learning and growing, you're working with other people, you're discovering things, you're living a much more engaged, involved life. So I think it is available to everybody. It's just everybody hasn't understood what it really takes to transform. And when you do, and you're willing to do it, the results are amazing.
So, but it's not just the how; it's the why, the how, and then the discipline to execute on it.
Right, right. And I think to realize how hard it is at one level is important, because if you know that, and you also, you need good coaches, you need good training, good skills. We use assignments with the assignment way of living, life assignments. So we give people in sequences that build these capacities and break it down into little steps so that you can do this little step and then you add on another little step, and all of a sudden you realize you've covered a ton of territory and it's really much more long lasting. But you have to understand, we need one another. We need teachers, we need mentors, we need support, we need people to inspire us. If you're thinking about like an Olympic champion or a boxer or whatever, they always have sparring partners and people that they're running with and competing with and inspiring them. We do need other people to really help us on this journey. And what a great way to live, though, when you're engaged with other people in that way.
Sure, sure. And those shared experiences are the stock and trade of relationship and friendship, aren't they?
You know, they are beautiful. I mean, it's really, it's one of the, some of the deepest bonding is learning and growing together and going through things together and getting discouraged and getting back up together and encouraging one another. Our deepest bonds are really made through things like that, and it creates a lot of our intimacy with people.
Yeah, it sure does. It reminds me, when you talk about the discipline component, of one of the great Jim Rohn quotes, that late Jim Rohn, "Pain of discipline weighs ounces, the pain of regret weighs tons." And it's just sort of, we each have to at some point overcome ourselves and sort of start moving down the path, and then opportunities start to open up and things just start to work, don't they?
Well, I think that's true. We have to have some momentum in order to get, we can get redirected if we're moving, but it's really hard to do something when we're really inert. You know, the sixth phase we found in our research is what we call dedicating. And I think it speaks to what you're talking about, because when you're really dedicated, when you've made a commitment that, wait, this is just how I'm going to live, this is how I'm going to be, I'm going to dedicate myself to learning and growing, following my deeper yearnings, being a more conscious, engaged, involved, present human being, however, whatever word someone uses for that, then you start to actually develop the disciplines and the practices and the rhythms and the routines and the lifestyles that support this kind of engagement that keeps you from living a life of regret. But it allows you to really, and you actually feel better when you're more disciplined. Many of us resist it, but you actually end up having a little more self-respect. You feel better about yourself for being true to your word, for taking steps towards your own well-being. And the people who dedicating, rematrixing and dedicating were the two things that we saw in our research that really made the difference between someone learning and growing a bit and people really transforming, becoming someone they wouldn't even imagine becoming, because it takes that level of dedication and discipline to do that. And most people don't realize that, or haven't been willing, or haven't been taught, but it's not out of the reach of any of us once we know that. And I think that quote you gave is really beautiful.
Tell people where they can learn more, and the books, I'm sure, are available, Amazon, all the usual places, but what is your website?
It's Judith Wright, and that's Wright with a W, judithwright.com, and there's all, you can get the books through there, or else obviously online, but there's also free downloadable products and supports. We also have a complimentary training for anyone listening. You can get yourself to Chicago. We've got an $800 gift for you to come, and I can actually teach you these skills of transform. So there's all kinds of ways we'd love to support you. So it's all on Judith Wright with a W, judithwright.com.
Fantastic. And Judith, you know, maybe give out one final thought or an action step that people can take that will make a difference today.
I think there's two things I'd say. One is that we all deserve to live a great life. We need to know that and act on it, even if we don't believe it or feel it, that it really is true. And one step I think to do today, one is to really, the engaging step is what I would really say, this engaging phase. And that means live today as an adventure. Take some risks. Do something different. Break out of a rut and routine. Do a tiny little thing you wouldn't have done. Because once you start to live more engaged and take more risk, a lot more things open up for you.
Fantastic advice. Well, Judith Wright, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate having you on the show.
It's been great being with you. Thanks so much.
This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.